30th anniversary of the ARIA Hall of Fame this year, November 23, and about time Crowded House were inducted to the Hall of Fame, and coincidentally, on Crowded House's 30th anniversary. Very happy to say that to celebrate the 30th anniversary, Crowded House are reissuing every one of their albums. And not only do you get to hear the albums all over again, but there's a wealth of bonus material, which we're going to be covering off with the best people possible. One is Neil Finn, and the other is Nick Seymour. But I get the feeling, Neil, that Nick hasn't quite turned up yet.
Nick is, for the first time, trying to navigate Uber, and he's already had two cars speed off on him, and apparently he's up for $10 in fines.
Oh, no.
As we speak. But he'll be walking in the door very shortly, and this is a great opportunity for us to slag him off while he's not here, which is always has been the rule for Crowded House.
That is a very good thing. And you are, just to clarify to everybody, you're in the Capitol building, the iconic Capitol building in Los Angeles.
We are, yes. And I haven't been here for quite some time. We did record our first album here. We recorded the rhythm tracks anyway. And quite a few other things along the way. There's another Australian band playing in the car park tonight, Empire of the Sun. So, really, there's a bit of a takeover happening.
Neil, let's go back to the mid-80s. Split Enz have called it a day. The era of Split Enz has been so well documented and is so well loved that we won't focus on that. But here you are with the late, the very much missed Paul Hester about to embark upon your next step. It's the mid-80s. You're in your mid-20s at this stage. And what did you have in mind in putting the band together? Was the three-piece basic format of the band already in your head?
We did talk about wanting a small band. You know, we jokingly referred to our ability to fit into one rental car as being our prime motivation. But actually a small band after a big band, Split Enz, was a six-piece and a big sound. So we thought it'd be good to keep it simple. Nick Seymour accosted me at an after show. He's just walked in, by the way.
Hello.
Hey, Nick.
Hey.
How much are you up for fines and from Uber?
Oh, my God. What a nightmare that's been. Uploading new operating systems and just,
He's living in the west country of Ireland now. They don't have Uber over there. He's having to hit the ground running in a big way coming to Hollywood.
Nick, you missed the very big intro we did before where we obviously acknowledge the fact that we're talking to each other at the moment because it is your 30th anniversary. You're about to be inducted into the ARIA Hall of Fame and your body of work is being re-released with all sorts of bonus tracks, which I, as a Nuffy, have been enjoying listening to with the sneak peek that I've had. And we'll talk about those in detail. In fact, let's start now. We're talking about the debut album right here, right now. Originally 11 tracks on the album, 28 tracks now in this bonus edition with all sorts of demo versions and unreleased songs on it. And Neil, at the time you were in your mid-20s and it's one of the great love albums, and I hope you're taking this the right way. How do you, when you're in your mid-20s, write achingly beautiful songs about love and guilt and remorse when you're only 25 and you should be really shallow?
Well, I mean, I think that in the passage of time, songs sometimes raise themselves above what I initially imagined them as. And I think I was just kind of bluffing in my way through. And there's an element of personal experience, an element of fantasy, an element of bluff, an element of hard work in every song, particularly lyrically. A few of them pop out quite quickly. Don't Dream It's Over was one in particular that came quite quickly. But you're just trying to find words that when you say them, they make you feel something. And then I think there's an empathy then in the listener that you hope they'll feel the same thing, or maybe in some cases something completely different that you didn't imagine. But thank you for your kind words. And any depth that people give me or ascribe to me, I'll willingly accept.
Thank you so much. Something so strong as the next track we're going to have a look at. I've got Neil Finn and Nick Seymour on the line from the iconic Capitol building in LA. Something so strong. The demo for this was the one that you and Paul, Neil, went around shopping the band, to use industry speak. Is that right?
Well, it was. In fact, there was two demos for this. I'm not sure if they both made the final cut of this vastly big trove of material we've put out. But one of the more pastoral sort of sounding, more kind of an aching sort of folky kind of a treatment. Mitchell Froome took this one by the scruff of its neck and suggested an R&B bass line and changed the chords around for me and said, have you got a melody that could go over this? I thought this might work better. And I was very excited that somebody had the balls to throw the song up in the air. I remember coming back to seeing Nick and Paul after a day working with Mitchell on pre-production. and I had a demo that we'd made on his blaster box, and they thought they were in a kind of an English-oriented pop band before I left for the writing session, and by the time I came back, they realised they were in a sort of a pop band that had some R&B kind of things going on as well. So that was a great discovery.
We are celebrating 30 years of Crowded House and the reissue of all of their albums. At the moment, we're having a look at the Crowded House album, the debut album, the eponymous album, and we're up to the first single that was actually released as a single from the album. That's Mean to Me. And your New Zealand roots are there in the lyrics with the sound of Te Awamutu involved in there. And that, of course, for people who don't know, is your hometown.
It is my hometown, yeah. It means meeting of the waters. In fact, in reality, two tiny little streams that, you know, barely exist. But a lovely little country town in New Zealand. And, yeah, that was a sort of based on a true tale of a girl who had written to me and said she was coming to New Zealand from America and she had to meet me, and she'd had a terrible time in her life and it would mean so much to her. And she put a lot of pressure on me, and so I did meet with her on a tour of New Zealand I was doing, and I had a really raging fever, so I had to go to bed after saying a quick hello, and I couldn't sleep, but I came back to the hotel bar a little bit later just to see what was going on, and she was dancing in the arms of a poet, as the song relates, who fed her some line of rubbish about having gone to school with me, which was completely untrue. Having made the song and included her in the song, she turned up at the Capitol car park, actually, funnily enough, years later and said, "I'm the Mean to Me girl." And she was quite upset about the fact that I'd put it in the song and written it about her. But I tried to placate her and explained to her that songs are, you know, they just come out the way they come out. Anyway, by the next time I saw her, only a couple of months later, she was delighted that she was the girl in the Mean to Me song. She had all these other fans that had kind of, you know, contacted her, and they were really enamored of, you know, having been in touch with her. So yeah, so just goes to show. I don't know what it goes to show, but it, you know,
it goes to show that they love it.
They love it when you talk about them.
We are celebrating 30 years of Crowded House and the re-release of their debut album, Crowded House, along with every other album in their catalogue. You're talking about the fact that these albums give fans of the band a bit of an insight into the process of getting to a song. One of the demos is for a song called Stranger Under Your Skin, very familiar to fans of the band as the genesis of another song, isn't it?
Yeah, now we're getting somewhere. It was went through a couple of different incarnations. We were looking for different verses. You know, I think there are other writers that have these merry-go-round process of sticking this bit with that bit. But I do think that in some cases my stuff goes through bigger transitions than most. Mitchell didn't think that Stranger Under Your Skin was a complete song, and he often had ideas to stick some things together. I like being brutal with things. You know, it's good to treat them with a bit of disrespect, you know, not get too precious with them. Let them live in any given day and let them improve. Let them prove themselves.
We are celebrating 30 years of Crowded House. What an epic journey the band has been on. Ups, downs, a roller coaster. And I'm very pleased to say Neil Finn and Nick Seymour are joining me on the line to talk about Temple of Low Men, album number two. The dreaded album number two. Did you suffer second album syndrome with this? And perhaps explain to people what second album syndrome is.
Nick, second album syndrome?
What they referred to it as the sophomore syndrome in the United States. And that was that, well, in a band's situation, it'd take you 5 years to write your first album, and then you've got like 10 months to come up with the second one. So that's one explanation. And another is that it's just always hard to get the second one to the same lofty heights as the first, you know, for the promotions department in the record label.
And, you know, also you become completely neurotic from having become successful. So that's the thing, you know, you're an absolute mental wreck.
You're starting to make really silly decisions like, you know, what hat will I wear to the studio today, as opposed to just going into the studio and doing it.
Just to follow that thought on, I mean, we had a really good time making our second record. We really enjoyed it. It was regarded as a darker record than the first, and certainly lyrically and maybe sonically we were in a slightly different, darker space, but we actually had a really easy and fun process making it.
You refer to the fact that you were in a darker space. Some, you know, some people have said that the album is more personal or more introspective. Is that a difficult thing to do as a songwriter? And is that difficult as performers to do that, to actually bear your inner soul like that?
It's easier to be introspective than outrospective, to be honest, because I actually don't even know if that word exists, but it should.
I like it.
Being outgoing and upbeat is much harder for me anyway, as a songwriter. You know, Pharrell Williams is a master of being an upbeat. That's why he's successful, and duly so. I find it easier to write ballads, and I've always been attracted to melancholy songs, even when I was a young teenager without a care in the world. So it's just the way it is.
Let's move on to the first track of the album. And just as a little side note, how do you work out which one is going to be the first track of the album? Is that something the band does?
The sequence of an album always comes down to band and producer. I mean, there might be somebody else who's got a keen interest in those things who throws their two cents worth in, but obviously want something to set the mood straight away, give people an idea of what they're getting into. It's a really important thing to get right. So you can taking your time is a good thing.
The song that you selected to set the mood right away is I Feel Possessed. What can you tell us about it before we play it?
Oh, look, it features a really lovely bit of Wurlitzer playing from Mitchell, who was very nice at finding little signature things. It has a sense of mystery. I think we were quite keen to show that we had more nuances in what we were presenting on the second record. Perhaps the first album was a more straight-ahead pop record. This was I Feel Possessed had a sort of mysterious elements.
Into Temptation is the next track we want to talk about. The home demo for that, obviously a whole lot quicker than the version that we're all accustomed to.
Well, I made two or three different little recordings of pieces. This song was put together from a number of pieces as well. The demo you're referring to is it's quite an upbeat one. I don't know. I just bought a drum machine. I think that was the key there. So everything from that album and the other demos that are also on this collection will feature this Yamaha drum machine that I had, which had a particular sound and probably encouraged me to be a little more up. Once we got to rehearsal, it was clear that Into Temptation in its eventual form, had a real power by being played back in a more kind of stately, spooky kind of manner. And Nick found a lovely bass kind of sequence, and Paul came up with it. I mean, he was a master of the brushes, and it was a perfect song for brushes. I remember rehearsals in South Melbourne. We sort of looked at each other after the first time we played it well and thought, hey, this is really something, this one. And Mitchell also had a very strong reaction to this song.
Talking with Neil Finn and Nick Seymour from Crowded House, celebrating 30 years together. And when we say 30 years together, it's not always like that for a band. There are ups, there are downs. And during this period, it'd be fair to say, Nick and Neil, that the grind of being on the road and living in close proximity to each other was starting to pay a bit of a toll on the two of you? Have I gone to a dark place here?
No, we've talked about it before a little bit too, but we were making demos at the time, and yeah, there was some schism happened, but quite quickly resolved by Nick coming around to see me and saying, this is ridiculous. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? And I went, yeah, you're right. Okay, let's not do it.
It was about a month. And it was in the break between Temple of Low Men and the start of Woodface.
Oh, was it that? Was it afterwards then? Okay. Yeah. I can't remember the sequence here, right? Yeah, you're right, yeah.
And so we were sort of looking to demo new songs and start, you know, a new writing sequence. We had to sort of vent our spleens of what had annoyed us about touring on the previous record and, you know, just needed a break, really.
Yeah, I mean, getting on the rounds, I mean, it's exciting, it's exhilarating, it's exhausting, it's a lot of attention, which doesn't necessarily bring out the best in people when they're surrounded by people who are only interested in talking about what they're doing. And, you know, I think your relationships get strained. Happens in a lot of bands, why bands have trouble staying together, you know. But we resolved that, we got through it. It was a little trial separation. Didn't really go off and root anybody else, so that was, you know, not a disaster.
And then you hugged it up, and here we are all together again, which is all fabulous. When You Come is the next song that we're going to be playing. What would you like to say about it before we actually roll it out?
Well, I remember writing When You Come in Melbourne, and it was the first time I'd actually written in a sort of stream of consciousness words that, you know, they just poured out in one go, and it was a different sort of lyric than I'd ever written before, and seemed to have a certain power in its simplicity as a song. Took to rehearsal well, took to, you know, Nick and Paul getting involved really well, and was a song we opened the set with quite often. And I don't know what else to say. I was thinking of the sort of birth of the universe and the great forces of nature. It did get interpreted in other ways by people, but that's okay. I'm fond of it.
When You Come, recorded for the album Temple of Low Men at Platinum Studios in Melbourne. The studios influence the feel of an album more than just from a technology point of view?
only in their familiarity, really. You know, you get comfortable into a place and you can actually marry the space with where you normally rehearse, or, you know, it's just a comfort zone, really. And Platinum was on Chapel Street, you know, and it was fantastically located for babe watching when we used to cross Toorak Road amongst all the boutiques and cafes, checking out the girls that worked in the shoe shops. So it was fantastic.
Strangely, though, we only found this out because when we worked on the album Together Alone, Youth, our producer at the time, who was quite into sort of esoteric pursuits, absolutely freaked out when we got to Platinum, because right opposite in a new building they'd put up was 666 Chapel Street. And he regarded that as the number of the devil and didn't even want to work there for a while.
It's the number of the beast, man.
Can't work.
I don't know if I can stay.
I know.
There's a live version of Sister Madly on this album, which is the one we're about to play. And this is a song that you would always have a slightly different twist on the lyric every time you performed it. There's a reference in this one to Angus playing Scrabble. And I presume Angus is your sound guy, is that right?
Yeah. I remember that. Paul used to refer to Angus as Scrabble quite often because Angus was very competitive and fought for the most ridiculous words, actually, which now I probably were legit, but we didn't acknowledge them at the time. Yeah, Sister Maddie enabled us to get very loose, and at times used to jam off on that for a good 10, 15 minutes, find other songs.
Yeah, to throw in the middle of
it. In the middle of it. Yeah. And Paul was up the front doing what he did best, playing brushes and doing a few pirouettes. And yeah, it was just a really nice, loose moment in the set. So
it was almost like a party piece song in some ways, because it was the point where we could actually do that busk thing where Paul would actually play two guitars with his brushes.
He'd play the bass and the acoustic. With his brushes, you know, and sometimes remove his clothing. Not all the time, but...
He loved nudity.
It did happen.
Sister Madly featuring, obviously, the late, the great, and the still very sorely missed Paul Hester in the band. And, of course, with Paul's departure, there was a need to look elsewhere, and Beck's drummer, Matt Sherritt, came into the equation.
Well, we decided when we had our second incarnation that we were going to really be very serious about finding the right drummer, out of respect for Paul and for trying to make the thing live up to all the affection that we felt from our audience. So Matt had auditioned along with a bunch of other people. I can't remember how his name came into the mix, but he didn't know much about Crowded House, knew a couple of the songs, but he just came and impressed us with his solid bass drum and his presence, his big smiley face and genuine spirit. So it wasn't a hard decision in the end.
The final track on Temple of Low Men that we're looking at today is Better Be Home Soon, 1989. ARIA Album of the Year. Best group you got as well. Best cover, Nick, flexing another part of your creative repertoire there. How does the musical connection that you have obviously with the band flow creatively into a graphic design as well?
I always wanted to actually put images of the band members on the covers. You know, the way they coloured their homes, the natural collections of stuff that they had. Neil always had wind-up toys and curios and, you know, it was a culmination of the character of the personalities in the band.
And, of course, another award for Temple of Low Men was for the Song of the Year, Better Be Home Soon. What can you tell us about that before we play it?
I remember the day that I brought that to the band. It was a song that came very quickly and very easily, and I hadn't really written one that was that direct and with a country tinge, which I didn't think I had in me, really. I just said, I wrote this new song, and I played it to them, and they were doing three-part harmonies on it as a warm-up. And when we recorded it, we felt like it was a great follow-up to Don't Dream It's Over. In fact, our manager of the time, Gary Stamler in America, made a very brash and ultimately foolish prediction of how many weeks it was going to be number one in America.
I don't know that it made it to number one, did it?
It actually stalled in the 40s, so I don't know what happened exactly, but it was certainly number one in Canada. It was number one in Australia and New Zealand. I think it did pretty well in other places as well. Well, it might have been number one in Israel, I think.
It's one of my favourite songs.
Yeah. Travelled a long way, that one, and a lot of people love it. We finish the show with it quite often.
We are celebrating 30 years of Crowded House. Neil Finn and Nick Seymour joining me to talk about album number 3, released in 1991. The album is Woodface. 14 tracks on the original album, 21 bonus tracks, including a whole bunch of live songs. After Temple of Low Men and the tour, you took a little bit of a break to re-energise, I suppose, and perhaps to just clear the mind a little bit. You put the band on pause for a little bit and regrouped with your brother Tim and started writing songs with him for the first time in quite a while for a possible Finn Brothers album. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And as it turns out, you and Tim played an acoustic gig as the Finn Brothers at IDs, but in the support act was a couple of other brothers. Do you recall the night, Nick?
Oh, my God. Right, that was the first time I'd ever kind of played with Mark. And I remember ranting about there was a tramways strike in Melbourne. They were getting rid of the conductors. It's before the tramways were privatised. And I remember doing a rant in the middle of the gig that I'd done with Mark and I were on stage. And Neil started heckling from the audience.
Oh, I don't remember that.
You were. You yelled, "Right on!"
Yeah. Right.
Let's show the man. Let's tell it to the man.
Well, you guys were both real, like, rabid bloody Labourites.
Well, we were kind of, you know, real sort of, you know, trades hall council kind of,
yeah.
You know. To be honest, what we actually said, or what I
was it
said,
Kennett's bloody Melbourne at that time, wasn't it?
It actually came true. I mean, they privatised the trams. They got rid of the conductors.
Kennett's just, bloody Melbourne.
Rather than digging up, at least they didn't dig up the tramways lines.
So you still haven't got over it. I would have been heckling you then because that was just as boring then as it is now.
I can't believe this conversation has steered towards the trade union. Solidarity.
I'm finding this remarkable. All this history, this crowded house history, and we're talking about the tram strike in Melbourne. Yeah.
It was a good gig at IDs, though, I recall. It was the first time my brother and I actually played together on stage, and, yeah. You know, it was fun.
Fraternity is a good thing, musical fraternity. But I think Tim and I got drawn into, we wanted to do this music. We wrote a whole bunch of songs, and we were making a crowded house album at the time, Woodface, obviously. We got to a point where we had about 7 or 8 songs we really liked, but we were still missing 2 or 3. And they seemed to converge. Then the idea of having a ring-fenced bunch of songs of Tim and mine that were current, fresh, and exciting suddenly seemed quite weird. And, you know, we brought Tim in the band and finished off and made a great record.
Serendipity.
Was serendipity. It was, you know, hard to know how it was all going to pan out. You know, I dropped it into Paul and Nick's lap as almost a done deal, which I probably had a tendency to do a little bit. And they took it reasonably well, but I think there was a wry look on their face like, oh, this will be interesting. We were recording at Tim's studio in Caulfield. We'd already done a pretty damn good version of Weather With You, and I think There Goes God was one that came out at that time. These songs just seemed to be fresh and would really enhance the album, and the band took them and played them really well as well. So I think it was a great thing for the album.
Weather With You is the song you just referred to. Could you also please explain where 57 Mount Pleasant Street is?
I think there's almost every city in the world has a Mount Pleasant Street. In fact, our sister lived in Auckland in Mount Pleasant Street. It just came to mind on the day we were writing that song. It was the very first day we got together to write songs. He had the title, Weather With You, and he had the first line, walking around the room singing Stormy Weather. We just wrote it kind of very quickly based off the back of that, and we knew there was something pretty special happening. We hadn't written together before that, so it just came out of nowhere.
The first single on the album is Chocolate Cake, which also includes the line, "The excess fat on your American bones." Did that hamper the success of the song in the United States? You're a bit touchy about that.
It was a very strange story on that whole thing, really. I mean, we thought that was funny and it just sounded good. It sang well, you know.
It is funny.
Didn't really give it too much. And it is funny. And actually, there's some truth in it. It's still current, really, still relevant, but there was a few people who got a bit touchy about it, and I remember there was a Rolling Stone review of Woodface, and they made a reference to it and saying, oh, it's all really well for them to come over and tour and make money out of America, but now they're slagging us off or something. So a few touchy people about it. Yeah, making it the first single was possibly not a very wise thing to do. But we were stumbling along in all our finery.
It was Capital's call, as I recall, though, wasn't it?
Well, I think maybe it was Gary Stamler's call. But everyone denies it. In the book, there's actually one of the best pages in the book that Chris Burke wrote about Crowded Houses, everybody telling their version of events about how that ended up as the first single, and everyone blames everybody else.
Right.
It was also around about this time, Neil, that you were an expectant father, and I will take this moment, if I may, to congratulate you on just becoming a grandfather.
Hooray! Yeah, I'm very, very excited. I'm floating on air.
Little boy?
Little boy, yeah.
To be named.
That was going to be my next question. Where does Neil feature? Is it the first? Is it the second? The third name? Where? Surely you've insisted somewhere.
Neil Jr. Cornelius. I was nearly Cornelius, actually, when I was I was going to be christened Cornelius. So I should have really stuck to that name. It was quite a good one, I thought.
Needless to say, congratulations. I think that is just fabulous. And what a
Thank you. It is wonderful, yeah.
Joyous. Absolutely.
Very exciting.
Fall at Your Feet is the next song that we'd like to play. What can you tell us before we play it?
Well, I think there's a couple of demos of this, maybe one at least. And this song went through massive transitions. We were looking for a verse for a chorus, which we knew was very strong. Maybe tried three or four out. Eventually, one day in Melbourne at Platinum, I was playing an old thing, which became the verse of Fall at Your Feet. And Mitchell said, "That's it. That's the one. Stick that with the chorus." Seemed to work perfectly. And we immediately laid it down, had the song recorded and kind of almost finished by the end of the day, really. But it got stalled in the blocks for a long time. It just goes to show that, you know, there's a lot of endurance you have to apply to music making. And you keep believing. And, you know, before it's brilliant, it's sometimes deeply flawed.
What do you think in terms of the overdubs that we were doing for it? How did it get stalled?
Because it was not written as a song. The verse was wrong. We had two or three different verses in it, and they were just the wrong verses. The song didn't reach its full potential until we found the right verse. And then it was simple and easy to do.
Question without notice here. Out of the entire body of work, if there was one song that could somehow become the statue, the monument to Crowded House, which one would it be?
Well, I'd be very resistant to answering that question, Lee, even though, you know, I know it was asked with good intentions. But
favourite child
and
stuff?
And I don't like to... Well, it is, yeah. I mean, as you sort of, you have to...
That's fine.
I don't want to draw that. I don't want to draw... Yeah. But Nick may have one. Nick might be able to answer that.
In terms of everyone being in the right place at the right time in the studio together to characterise or render one of Neil's songs, I think Fall at Your Feet was actually one of those moments in the studio for me, and Four Seasons in One Day is another, where the band really nailed the tempo exactly right, and Paul was very, very relaxed in his drumming.
Four Seasons in One Day is the song that we're actually about to play, Nick. Neil, I think you are the one who said that Melbourne is the town that you chose to return to. It was the birthplace of Crowded House. And you go on to say, it's forever deeply ingrained in our collective psyche and was the backdrop for many of our best musical moments. Is it too presumptuous of people in Melbourne to say that Four Seasons in One Day is a song about Melbourne?
Well, I mean, I wish I could just say yes, because in a way it was.
I wish you could too.
Melbourne, but it was. But really, it's a song that has another, you know, an inner landscape about the workings of your brain. And so in a way, it could be about any city or any set of circumstances. But I'm being a little bit oblique. It was written, I mean, there's a line that says, you know, the sun shines on the dark clouds hanging over the Domain. And anyone that lives in Melbourne knows what it's like when the cool change happens and those big clouds roll in and the sun's still out and it's the temperature's dropping by about 10, 15 degrees in about half an hour. Yeah, Four Seasons in One Day. I mean, that's, you know, that was the setting. That was the setting for that song.
Guys, lovely chatting and many, many thanks.
Thanks, Lee.
Good on you, Lee.
Take care.
Cheers. See you, mate.
Bye-bye.